Chapter 8, Environmental Issues. Illinois Environmental Controls. The Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, IEPA, is charged with maintaining and enhancing the state's air, land, and water quality through education, inspection, regulation, enforcement, recycling, and prevention activities. The Pollution Control Board and Hazardous Waste Advisory Council are two of the many bodies created to assist the IEPA in specific areas. Most Illinois environmental regulations are required by statute to be identical in substance to environmental protection regulations established by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. Hazardous substances. Asbestos. Asbestos is a fire-resistant mineral that was once used extensively as insulation and to strengthen other materials. A component of more than 3,000 types of building materials, asbestos was found in most construction, including residential, until 1978 when its use was banned. The EPA estimates that, even today, about 20% of the nation's commercial and public buildings have asbestos-containing materials, ACMs. Asbestos was used to cover pipes, ducts, and heating and hot water units. Its fire-resistant properties made it a popular material for use in floor tile, exterior siding, roofing products, linoleum flooring materials, joint compounds, wallboard material, backing, and mastics. Though some ACMs are easy to identify, example insulation around heating and water pipes, identifying asbestos may be more difficult when it is behind walls or under floors. Asbestos is highly friable, meaning that as it ages, asbestos fibers break down easily into tiny filaments and particles. This makes asbestos especially harmful when it is disturbed or exposed and becomes airborne, as often occurs during renovation or remodeling. Those who have inhaled asbestos fibers often develop serious and deadly respiratory diseases decades later. While federal regulations establish guidelines for owners of public and commercial buildings to test for asbestos-containing materials, there are no guidelines regarding the presence of asbestos in residential properties. Because improper removal procedures may further contaminate the air within the structure, the process requires state-licensed technicians and specially sealed environments. The waste generated must be disposed of at a licensed facility, which further adds to the cost of removal. Encapsulation, or the sealing off of disintegrating asbestos, is an alternate method of asbestos control that may be preferable to removal in certain circumstances. However, an owner must periodically monitor the condition of the encapsulated asbestos to make sure it is not disintegrating. Only a certified asbestos inspector should perform an asbestos inspection of a structure to identify which building materials may contain asbestos. The inspector can also provide recommendations and costs associated with remediation. It is vital that a buyer knows where asbestos-containing materials are located so that they are not disturbed during any repair, remodeling, demolition, or even routine use. Appraisers also should be aware of the possible presence of asbestos. Lead-based paint and other lead hazards. Lead was used as a pigment and drying agent in alkyd oil-based paint. Lead-based paint may be on any interior or exterior surface, but it is particularly common on doors, windows, and other woodwork. The federal government estimates that lead is present in about 75% of all private housing built before 1978, or approximately 57 million homes, ranging from low-income apartments to million-dollar mansions. Children younger than 6 are the most vulnerable to damage from excessive lead levels. Elevated levels of lead in children cause learning disabilities, developmental delays, reduced height, and poor hearing, and the effects are generally irreversible. Excessive exposure in adults can induce anemia and hypertension, trigger gallbladder problems, and cause reproductive problems in both men and women. Lead dust can be ingested from the hands by a crawling infant, inhaled by any occupant of a structure, or ingested from the water supply because of lead pipes or lead solder. Soil and groundwater may be contaminated by everything from lead plumbing and leaking landfills to discarded skeets and bullets from an old shooting range. High levels of lead have been found in soil located near waste-to-energy incinerators. In 1996, the EPA and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, issued final regulations, known as the Lead-Based Paint Hazard Reduction Act, LBPHRA, of 1992, which requires the disclosure of the presence of any known lead-based paint hazards to potential buyers or renters. The federal law does not require that anyone test for the presence of lead-based paint. LBPHRA requires the following from sellers and landlords of residential dwellings built before 1978. Landlords must disclose known information on lead-based paint and hazards before leases take effect. Leases must include a disclosure form regarding lead-based paint. Sellers have to disclose known information on lead-based paint and hazards prior to an execution of a contract for sale. Sales contracts must include a completed disclosure form about lead-based paint. This is the form for sellers and is slightly different from the form for landlords. Licensees should use EPA written disclosure forms rather than creating their own forms. Buyers have up to 10 days to conduct a risk assessment or an inspection for the presence of lead-based paint hazards. Licensees provide buyers and lessees with Protect Your Family from Lead in Your Home, the pamphlet created by the EPA, HUD, and the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. Renovators must give homeowners the Protect Your Family from Lead in Your Home pamphlet before starting any renovation work. Beginning April 2010, federal law requires anyone who is paid to perform work that disturbs paint in housing and child-occupied facilities to be trained and certified in the EPA's new lead-based work practices. This includes residential rental property owners, managers, general contractors, and special trade contractors, e.g., painters, plumbers, carpenters, electricians. The renovation, repair, and painting RANDAMP wink with tongue sticking out program involves pre-renovation education. This education includes distribution of the pamphlet Renovate Right to the property owners before work commences. Licensees must ensure that all parties comply with the law. Sellers, lessors, and renovators are required to disclose any prior test results or any knowledge of lead-based paint hazards. With only a very narrow exception, all real estate licensees, subagent, buyer's agent, and facilitator are required to advise sellers to make the required disclosures. Only buyer's agents who are paid entirely by the buyer are exempt. The regulations apply to housing built prior to 1978 with the following six exceptions. 1. Property sold at foreclosure, although the disclosure must be made at resale time. 2. Rental property that is certified lead-based paint-free by an inspector who is certified under a federal program or federally authorized state certification program. 3. Property leased for 100 days or less, with no lease renewal or extension. 4. Renewals of existing leases if disclosure was made at the time of the initial lease. 5. Units with no bedrooms or with no separation between sleeping and living areas. 6. Housing for the elderly or disabled if children under the age of 6 are not expected to live there. There is considerable controversy about practical approaches for handling the presence of lead-based paint. Removal or encapsulation is sometimes utilized. Federal law requires that only licensed lead inspectors, abatement contractors, risk assessors, abatement project designers, and abatement workers may deal with the removal or encapsulation of lead in a structure. Anyone who performs lead abatement or mitigation activities without a license is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. The Department of Public Health, DPH, oversees the qualifying, training, and licensing of lead abatement contractors and lead abatement workers in Illinois. EPA guidance pamphlets and other information about lead-based hazards are available from the National Lead Information Center at 800-424-5323. The Illinois Lead Poisoning Prevention Act, 410 ILCS 45, requires that physicians screen children younger than 6 years old for lead poisoning when the child lives in an area considered by the state to be at high risk for lead exposure. High-risk areas include slum and blighted housing, proximity to highway or heavy local traffic, proximity to a lead-using or if the inspection identifies a lead hazard. The property owner is required to mitigate the condition within 90 days, 30 days if a child under 6 or a pregnant woman is at risk. Licensed lead abatement contractors must be used for lead removal. The owner will receive a certificate of compliance once the DPH is satisfied that the lead hazard has been removed. An owner who has received a lead mitigation notice must provide any prospective lessees for the affected unit with a written notice of the existence of an identified lead hazard. In addition, all owners of residential buildings or units must give current and prospective lessees information on the potential health hazards posed by lead and a copy of an informational brochure. 1978 is a year to remember. Lead paint and asbestos were both banned. Unleaded gasoline still has lead in it, so automobiles' exhaust fumes are considered to be one of the sources of lead. Radon. Radon is a naturally occurring, colorless, odorless, tasteless, radioactive gas produced by the decay of other radioactive substances. Radon is measured in picocuries, a unit of radiation, contained in a liter of air, i.e., PCIL. Radon is found in every state and territory, with radon levels in the outdoor air averaging 0.4 PCIL. Fans and thermal stack effects, i.e., rising hot air draws cooler air in from the ground through cracks in the basement and foundation walls, pulls radon into buildings. The potential for developing lung cancer from exposure to radon is directly correlated to the extent and length of a person's exposure to radon. Radon has been classified as a Class A known human carcinogen. Furthermore, smokers have a risk factor 15 times greater than non-smokers. Because neither the EPA nor current scientific consensus has been able to establish a threshold safe level of radon exposure, the EPA suggests an action level of 4 PCIL. The action level of 4 was chosen because 95% of the time, current technology can bring the level below 4, and 75% of the time, levels can be reduced to 2 PCIL. Radon mitigation is less expensive when the system is installed during construction. Mitigation consists of removing the radon before it seeps into the house. A fan is installed in a pipe running from the basement to the attic to draw the radon up and out. The Illinois Radon Awareness Act requires a seller to provide to a buyer, before the buyer is obligated under any contract to purchase residential real property, a disclosure of information on radon hazards along with a pamphlet entitled Radon Testing Guidelines for Real Estate Transactions, stating that the property may present the potential for exposure to radon. In short, the Act requires a separate disclosure document for radon to be included in the majority of residential real estate transactions. The disclosure document has a radon warning statement advising buyers that the home may pose a threat to their health if it has elevated levels of radon, and that all homes should be tested for radon. Requires that a seller provide an Illinois Emergency Management Agency, IEMA, approved pamphlet about general radon information to a buyer and disclose all information along with any available documentation of the radon levels in the home. Requires that real estate agents sign the disclosure to confirm that seller has been made aware of his/her obligations. Requires that all parties involved sign the disclosure acknowledging the transfer of the above information, and requires that sellers must disclose that they have no knowledge of elevated radon concentrations, or that prior elevated radon concentrations have been mitigated or remediated. The Act does not require that all homes in a real estate transaction be tested or that the home be mitigated if the test results are elevated. It also does not apply to the transfer of any residential dwelling unit located 3 stories or higher above ground level in any structure. If any of the required disclosures occur after the buyer has made an offer to purchase the residential real property, the seller shall complete the required disclosure activities prior to accepting the buyer's offer and allow the buyer an opportunity to review the information and possibly amend the offer. The provisions of this Act do not apply to transfers pursuant to court order, transfers from a mortgagor to a mortgagee by deed in lieu of foreclosure or consent judgment, transfer by judicial deed issued pursuant to a foreclosure sale, transfer by a collateral assignment of a beneficial interest of a land trust, or a transfer by a mortgagee or a successor in interest to the mortgagee's secured position, transfers by a fiduciary in the course of the administration of a decedent's estate, guardianship, conservatorship, or trust. Transfers from one co-owner to one or more other co-owners. Transfers pursuant to testate or intestate succession. Transfers made to a spouse or to a person or persons in the lineal line of consanguinity of one or more of the sellers. Transfers from an entity that has taken title to residential real property from a seller for the purpose of assisting in the relocation of the seller, so long as the entity makes available to all prospective buyers a copy of the disclosure form furnished to the entity by the seller. Transfers to or from any governmental entity, and transfers of any residential dwelling unit located 3 stories or higher above ground level in any structure. Formaldehyde. Formaldehyde, a colorless chemical with a strong, pronounced odor, is used widely in the manufacturing of building materials and many household products because of its preservative characteristics. Often emitted as a gas, formaldehyde is one of the most common and problematic volatile organic compounds, VOCs, and is one of the few indoor air pollutants that can be measured. Formaldehyde was listed as a hazardous air pollutant in the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. The largest source of formaldehyde in any building is likely to be the off-gassing from pressed wood products made from using adhesives that contain urea formaldehyde (UF) resins. It is also used in carpeting and ceiling tiles. Urea formaldehyde foam insulation, UFFI, once popular, then banned, and now legal again, is rarely used. Carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide, CO, is a colorless, odorless gas that occurs due to incomplete combustion as a byproduct of burning such fuels as wood, oil, and natural gas. Furnaces, water heaters, space heaters, fireplaces, and wood stoves all produce CO as a natural result of combustion. When these appliances function properly and are properly ventilated, CO emissions are not a problem. However, when improper ventilation or equipment malfunctions permit large quantities of CO to be released into a residence or commercial structure, it poses a significant health hazard. More than 300 deaths from carbon monoxide poisoning occur each year, with thousands of others requiring hospital emergency room care. Illinois requires that all residences be equipped with working carbon monoxide detectors. Polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. These consist of more than 200 chemical compounds that are not found naturally in nature. Flame resistant, they were often used in electrical equipment such as transformers, electrical motors in refrigerators, caulking compounds, and hydraulic oil in older equipment. The EPA has classified PCBs as reasonably carcinogenic, and they have been implicated in lower fertility and shortened lifespans. Although the commercial distribution of PCBs was banned in 1979, PCBs remain in the environment because burning them at more than 2,400 degrees in a closed environment is the only known way to destroy them. PCBs are most likely a concern for commercial and industrial property managers. These managers should ask the local utility company to identify and remove any type of transformer that might be a source of PCBs. If the PCBs leak into the environment, penalties and removal methods are expensive. Chlorofluorocarbons. Chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, are non-toxic, non-flammable chemicals containing atoms of carbon, chlorine, and fluorine. CFCs are most often used in air conditioners, refrigerators, aerosol sprays, paints, solvents, and foam blowing applications. Although CFCs are safe in most applications and are inert in the lower atmosphere, once CFC vapors rise to the upper atmosphere, they can deplete ozone. Electromagnetic fields. Electromagnetic fields, EMFs, are generated by the movement of electrical currents. The use of any electrical appliance creates a small field of electromagnetic radiation. Clock radios, blow dryers, televisions, and computers all produce EMFs. The major concern regarding EMFs involves high-tension power lines. The EMFs produced by these high-voltage lines, as well as by secondary distribution lines and transformers, are suspected of causing cancer, hormonal changes, and behavioral abnormalities. There is considerable controversy and much conflicting evidence about whether EMFs pose a health hazard. Mold. Mold can be found almost anywhere and can grow on almost any organic substance, so long as moisture, oxygen, and an organic food source are present. Moisture feeds mold growth. If a moisture problem is not discovered or addressed, mold growth can gradually destroy what it is growing on. There are over 2,000 types of mold. Mold can grow in sunlight, darkness, dry air, and in moisture. Today, many people are affected by mold, especially children. Newer homes today often have higher concentrations of mold compared to older homes. Newer homes are more tightly sealed and do not allow for air circulation. One way of minimizing mold growth is to vent all areas of the home, especially bathrooms and basements. In addition, some molds can cause serious health problems. They can trigger allergic reactions and asthma attacks. Some molds are known to produce potent toxins and/or irritants. Some moisture problems in homes and buildings have been directly linked to recent changes in construction practices. Some of these practices have resulted in buildings that are too tightly sealed, preventing adequate ventilation. The EPA has published guidelines for the remediation and/or cleanup of mold and moisture problems in schools and commercial buildings. The Illinois Toxic and Pathogenic Mold Prevention Act requires the Department of Public Health to adopt standards for reducing the occurrence of mold contamination in indoor environments. This law requires that owners of residential, commercial, and industrial properties disclose to all prospective buyers the existence of indoor mold. Remember, as real estate agents, we are not experts in identifying mold or advising property owners on the removal of any mold hazards. If your client has any questions about possible mold contamination, always refer your client to a licensed and certified expert for an evaluation and assessment report. Mold removal must be done by a licensed mold remediator only. HUD now requires mold disclosure on all HUD sales contracts. Mold disclosure forms are available through your state or local realtor association. Groundwater protection. Groundwater is the water that exists under the Earth's surface within the tiny spaces or crevices in geological formations. Groundwater forms the water table, the natural level at which the ground is saturated. The water table may be several hundred feet underground or near the surface. When the Earth's natural filtering systems are inadequate to ensure the availability of pure water, any contamination of underground water threatens the supply of pure, clean water for private wells or public water systems. Numerous state and federal laws have been enacted to preserve and protect the water supply. Water can be contaminated from a number of sources. Runoff from waste disposal sites, leaking underground storage tanks, and pesticides and herbicides are some of the main culprits. Because water flows naturally, contamination can spread far from its source. Once contamination has been identified, its source can usually be eliminated, and the water may eventually become or be made clean. However, the process can be time-consuming and expensive. Many property disclosure forms require sellers to identify the property's water source, such as well water, municipal water supply, or some other source. Anything other than a municipal water supply should be tested. Also, sellers are generally required to identify the type of septic system because an incorrectly placed or poorly functioning system can contaminate the water source. Underground storage tanks. Underground storage tanks, USTs, are commonly found on sites where petroleum products are used or where gas stations and auto repair shops are located. They also may be found in a number of other commercial and industrial establishments, including printing and chemical plants, wood treatment plants, paper mills, paint manufacturers, dry cleaners, and food processing plants for storing chemicals or process wastes. Military bases and airports are also common sites for underground tanks. In residential areas, they are used to store heating oil. Some tanks are currently in use, but many are long forgotten. Over time, neglected tanks may leak hazardous substances into the environment, permitting contaminants to pollute not only the soil around the tank, but also adjacent parcels and groundwater. Licensees should be particularly alert to the presence of fill pipes, vent lines, stained soil, and fumes or odors, any of which may indicate the presence of a UST. State and federal laws impose strict requirements on landowners to detect and correct leaks in an effort to protect the groundwater. The federal UST program is regulated by the EPA. The regulations apply to tanks that contain hazardous substances or liquid petroleum products and that store at least 10% of their volume underground. UST owners are required to register their tanks and adhere to strict technical and administrative requirements that govern installation, maintenance, corrosion prevention, overspill prevention, monitoring, and record keeping. Owners are also required to demonstrate that they have sufficient financial resources to cover any damage that might result from leaks. The following types of tanks are among those that are exempt from the federal regulations. Tanks that hold less than 110 gallons. Farm and residential tanks that hold 1,100 gallons or less of motor fuel used for non-commercial purposes. Tanks that store heating oil burned on the premises. Tanks on or above the floor of underground areas, such as basements or tunnels. Septic tanks and systems for collecting stormwater and wastewater in Illinois, the Leaking Underground Storage Tank, LUST, program governs the detection, identification, monitoring, mitigation, and removal of buried underground storage tanks, particularly those containing petroleum products. The program is administered by the State Fire Marshal and the IEPA and is authorized to disperse money from a special fund to assist property owners in complying with mandatory remediation activities. Waste disposal sites. Federal, state, and local regulations govern the location, construction, content, and maintenance of landfill sites built to accommodate the vast quantities of garbage produced every day in America. A landfill is an enormous hole, either excavated for the purpose of waste disposal or left over from surface mining operations. The hole is lined with clay or a synthetic liner to prevent leakage of waste material into the water supply. A system of underground drainage pipes permits the monitoring of leaks and leaching. Waste is laid on the liner at the bottom of the excavation, and a layer of topsoil is then compacted onto the waste. The layering procedure is repeated until the landfill is full, with the layers mounded up sometimes as high as several hundred feet. Environmental protection. The majority of legislation dealing with environmental problems has been enacted within the past four decades. Although the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, was created in 1970 at the federal level to oversee such problems, several other federal agencies' areas of concern generally overlap. The federal laws were created to encourage state and local governments to enact their own legislation. CERCLA, Superfund. The Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, CERCLA, was created in 1980. It established a fund of $9 billion, called the Superfund, to clean up uncontrolled hazardous waste sites and to respond to spills. It created a process for identifying potentially responsible parties, PRPs, and ordering them to take responsibility for the cleanup action. CERCLA is administered and enforced by the EPA. Liability. Landowners are liable under CERCLA when a release or a threat of release of a hazardous substance has occurred on their property, regardless of whether the contamination is the result of the landowner's actions or those of others. The owner can be held responsible for the cleanup. This liability includes the cleanup not only of the landowner's property but also of any neighboring property that has been contaminated. A landowner who is not responsible for the contamination can seek recovery reimbursement for the cleanup cost from previous landowners, any other responsible party, or the Superfund. However, if other parties are not available, even a landowner who did not cause the problem could be solely responsible for the costs. Once the EPA determines that hazardous material has been released into the environment, it is authorized to begin remedial action. First, it attempts to identify the PRPs. If the PRPs agree to cooperate in the cleanup, they must agree about how to divide the cost. If the PRPs do not voluntarily undertake the cleanup, the EPA may hire its own contractors to do the necessary work. The EPA then bills the PRPs for the cost. If the PRPs refuse to pay, the EPA can seek damages in court for up to 3 times the actual cost of the cleanup. Liability under the Superfund is considered to be strict, joint and several, and retroactive. Strict liability means that the owner is responsible to the injured party without excuse. Joint and several liability means that each of the individual owners is personally responsible for the total damages. If only one of the owners is financially able to handle the total damages, that owner must pay the total and collect the proportionate shares from the other owners whenever possible. Retroactive liability means that the liability is not limited to the current owner, but includes people who have owned the site in the past. Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act in 1986. The U.S. Congress reauthorized the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA. The amended statute contains stronger cleanup standards for contaminated sites and 5 times the funding of the original Superfund, which expired in September 1985. The amended act also sought to clarify the obligations of lenders. As mentioned, liability under the Superfund extends to both the present and all previous owners of the contaminated site. Real estate lenders found themselves either as present owners or somewhere in the chain of ownership through foreclosure proceedings. The amendments created a concept called innocent landowner immunity. It was recognized that in certain cases, a landowner in the chain of ownership was completely innocent of all wrongdoing and therefore should not be held liable. The Innocent Landowner Immunity Clause established the criteria by which to judge whether a person or business could be exempted from liability. The criteria included the following. The pollution was caused by a third party. The property was acquired after the fact. The landowner had no actual or constructive knowledge of the damage. Due care was exercised when the property was purchased. The landowner made a reasonable search, called an environmental site assessment, to determine that no damage to the property existed. Reasonable precautions were taken in the exercise of ownership rights. In practice, the EPA has conducted a number of studies to determine the impact on surrounding property values with regard to proximity to landfills and hazardous waste sites. In the report, Challenges in Applying Property Value Studies to Assess the Benefits of the Superfund Program, released January 2009, the EPA concluded the following. Impacts on surrounding residential property values vary in size and direction. Expected declines have been found, but increases in property values around Superfund sites have also been found. The direction of the price effect on surrounding home values appears to vary significantly with individual sites. Remedial action can reverse the decline at some sites. Delays in cleanup result in a more permanent decline in value. Liability of real estate licensees. Environmental law is relatively new. Although federal and state laws have defined many of the liabilities involved, common law is being used for further interpretation. Real estate licensees and all others involved in a real estate transaction must be aware of both actual and potential liability. Sellers often carry the most legal liability exposure. Innocent landowners might be held responsible, even though they did not know about the presence of environmental hazards. Purchasers may be held liable, even if they didn't cause the contamination. Lenders may end up owning worthless assets if owners default on the loans rather than undertaking expensive cleanup efforts. Real estate licensees could be held liable for improper disclosure, therefore, it is necessary to be aware of the potential environmental risks from neighboring properties such as gas stations, manufacturing plants, or even funeral homes. Discovery of environmental hazards. Real estate licensees are not expected to have the technical expertise necessary to discover the presence of environmental hazards. However, because they are presumed by the public to have special knowledge about real estate, licensees must be aware both of possible hazards and of where to seek professional help. The most appropriate people on whom a real estate licensee can rely for sound environmental information are scientific or technical experts. Environmental auditors or environmental assessors are scientific or technical experts who can provide the most comprehensive studies. Not only do environmental experts detect environmental problems, but they can also usually offer guidance about how best to resolve the conditions. Although environmental audits or assessments may occur at any stage in a transaction, they are most frequently a contingency that must be satisfied prior to closing. Environmental site assessments. An environmental site assessment is often performed on a property to show that due care was exercised in determining if any environmental impairments exist. The assessment can help prevent parties from becoming involved in contaminated property and work as a defense to liability. It is often requested by a lending institution, developer, or a potential buyer. The assessment is commonly performed in phases, such as Phase 1 or Phase 2. A Phase 1 environmental report is requested first to determine if any potential environmental problems exist at or near the subject property that may cause impairment. This consists of a visual inspection of the site and an inspection of any appropriate documentation. Phase 2 is the testing phase. Phase 3 is the mitigation phase, where the contamination is removed or mitigated. There are no federal regulations that define what an environmental assessment must include. However, one of the most accepted industry standards is provided by the American Society for Testing Materials International. A federally funded project requires that an environmental impact statement, EIS, be performed. These statements detail the impact the project will have on the environment. They can include information about air quality, noise, public health and safety, energy consumption, population density, wildlife, vegetation, and need for sewer and water facilities. Increasingly, these statements are also being required for private development. Disclosure of environmental hazards. State laws address the issue of disclosure of known material facts regarding a property's condition. These same rules apply to the presence of environmental hazards. A real estate licensee may be liable if, says, he should have known about a condition, even if the seller neglected to disclose it.